speakers are here. Listeners are not here.
Yeah. That's another thing. Good afternoon. Can you please take your seats? We are going to start because we have only 1 hour left for the FAO question and answer and dialogue portion. So let's start now. The 9th meeting of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is called to order. Distinguished members of the forum will continue an in-depth comprehensive dialogue with the Food and Agriculture Organization for another hour until 4 p.m. And after that, we will invite the representative of the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights. So let's, before we left this room, the members of the forum who have who are the focal persons for this, for the FAO part, have already raised some of their questions, and I guess this was also sent to you earlier. So now I would like to give you the opportunity to respond to some of these questions, and then we'll open the floor for the other statements. So please respond, and you are given only a few minutes for this. So who is going to go first? Eve.
Okay, thank you. The first question had to do with integration of ecosystems and adaptation to climate change and the potential of integrating disaster risk management within this. And it made a reference to wildfire issues and questions of North America and the status of indigenous peoples within developed countries and FAO's work in those areas. First, I would like to say that disaster risk management is closely connected to the issues of adaptation to climate change and ecosystems management. One of the things that FAO has been working on is helping to promote a move away from dealing just with emergency response kinds of approaches to actually recognizing the institutions, the customary institutions, and the local knowledge that's already in place in zones that are prone to disasters. Many parts of the world have had disasters periodically, historically. They have their own coping strategies. They have their own mechanisms for sharing and for supporting each other in case of crisis. So one of our approaches is to support disaster preparedness. So not just to look in terms of relief, but to really reinforce existing capacities so that the next time there is a disaster, it goes in ways, the support goes in ways that actually reinforce existing institutions and existing coping strategies. This is a fairly innovative approach, and it's something that we've been doing. We have case studies now in many countries, and it's something that we'd like to mainstream more. So we take the point about including disaster risk management within this and agree that it's important. Specifically connected to wildfires, FAO actually does have a set of guidelines on sustainable wildfire management. It's something that I think many people may not be aware of, but now that we think about it, it's actually very relevant for Indigenous peoples, and we'd be happy to share that with you. And it's looking at wildfires as, again, something that's recurrent in many places, and one can build capacities to prevent wildfires. Specifically, in connection to ecosystem approaches, I'd like to highlight some of the steps that we undergo when we're promoting ecosystem approaches, and I'd like to draw on the example of the basin of the Colombian Massif region. The first thing we do is we undertake a process of participatory demarcation of a basin with the local communities. We then work on implementing a protocol for monitoring trends in climate change, for example, in mountain ecosystems. And we involve vulnerable groups in the evaluation of the impacts of climate change. So in local perceptions of change are critical in defining how you monitor impacts. Most of the time, people living there have their own indicators developed, have a very complex system of understanding, and in disaster risk preparedness approaches and in ecosystem approaches, we're working very much now on trying to build on local identification of ecosystem changes and finding ways of getting decentralized authorities to respond to the trends that local populations are identifying. Then we also work with communities in identifying alternatives for adaptation to climate change in a particular watershed, and develop with them the planning and instruments for adaptation, as well as the proceedings and institutional mechanisms for doing so. One of the roles that FAO has is trying to play the role of a neutral, specialized agency in encouraging governments to engage with local stakeholders, including indigenous peoples, in the development of programs and in policies. And this is one of the things that we really can do, since we do have a presence in many countries. I'd like, on the question of North America and developed countries, this is a complex one for us. In an organization that's undergoing reform and that has is being encouraged to focus and to cut back and to really emphasize its key mandate, which is food security and reduction of hunger, the tendency has been to focus more and more on developing countries and on low-income developing countries specifically. The fact that indigenous peoples in developed countries have many of the characteristics of vulnerable groups in developing countries is an important point. Most of the ways in which we address this, though, at the moment, is through international instruments that we engage in. So some of the ones that I could mention would be things like the Rotterdam Convention and the role that we play in trying to restrict the use and distribution and promote the destruction of obsolete pesticides. Okay, this is something we know is very close to the heart of many indigenous communities. It's a role that FAO has been playing in many countries. The right to food guidelines is something that is equally valid in developed and in developing countries, and there are many developed countries that are using them in order to support vulnerable groups within them. Codex Alimentarius, the food code, the issues of food safety and food quality, is another international instrument that's used both in developed and developing countries. The questions of transboundary pests and diseases, this is a very important area. People have been talking a lot now in the media about swine flu. We have cutting-edge work on swine flu, on avian flu, and much of this, the tracking of transboundary diseases, of locusts, is done with local communities. Most of the transboundary transmission of diseases and pests can really only be monitored with people who happen to be on those boundaries. So we're working on developing improved systems for monitoring how pests and diseases are transferred, and trying even to use, in some cases, information communication technologies to promote the knowledge that is being gathered at the community level to be monitored by governments at higher levels. Okay, on the second question, on the question of the RED program, deforestation, it's called, reducing emissions for deforestation and forest degradation. FAO works in a program along with UNDP and UNEP to help support this. And each of the three agencies have different roles. UNEP's role is in convening and providing a secretariat function for the program. UNDP's role is focused on engagement with civil society and stakeholder consultations. FAO's role is primarily of a technical nature, and one of the key areas has to do with measurement, assessment, reporting, and verification, what they're calling MARV. And much of this work is really about monitoring forest trends and forest carbon trends. We're working on helping to establish a baseline on information at the global biome and regional levels on the status of forests and on forest deforestation over the last 30 years. FAO is also conducting a special study on best practices to facilitate sharing across countries, and we're supporting national forest monitoring and assessment programs to look at how carbon stocks are changing. We're also trying to build the capacity of national forest departments and other relevant stakeholders to engage effectively in RED negotiations. So that is where FAO's role is. Now, specifically connected to Indigenous peoples, one of the main areas is through the draft operational guidelines that is being used to engage Indigenous and other forest-dependent communities and to ensure that the considerations that local and Indigenous peoples have are integrated within the program. This is a living document. It's not a final document. It's something that requires continuous adaptation and consultation. So if you're not familiar with it, if you would like to have a copy of it, we would be very happy to provide it with you. It embodies three key elements. One has to do with representation. One has to do with transparency and access to information, and one has to do with participation and inclusion. We also know that the Indigenous peoples are represented within the civil society advisory group, as well as within the policy board of the RED program, and I believe Vicky, in fact, is one of the people engaged in this. We understand that there are special efforts being made to share the minutes of the meetings with national stakeholders, including Indigenous peoples, so that they can be validated on a rapid and consistent basis, and that there are consultations and engagement strategies to ensure that Indigenous peoples and forest-dependent communities can be involved in program design, implementation, monitoring, and verification. Okay. I'd like to go now for a moment to the issue of communication initiatives. And Eliana will address this question. If I understand it, the main question was about whether this plans to be expanded. We used the example of Bolivia, whether they will be expanded to other Latin American countries. I should just like to share, before saying this, that we in fact have several sub-regional networks within the Latin America region. And there are plans for doing this as well in Francophone Africa. And after Eliana speaks, we would like to invite some, if they're here, someone to speak about the Francophone initiative. So, Eliana.
Gracias,
Thank you. Now, addressing this question, in fact, this was an initiative of by Indigenous organizations from Latin America who met at international meetings to analyze the topic. Due to the marginalization of Indigenous people from the mass media, they don't have a lot of access to mass media, and it was seen as important to have a communication strategy and the means to articulate a vision by Indigenous peoples, system to bring together experiences, share those experiences, discuss topics and coordinate issues related to Indigenous policies, and furthermore to articulate the work done by Indigenous organizations with the permanent forum. And another issue was that through this platform, which was the mechanism identified by the Indigenous peoples, the forum indeed can connect better with Indigenous peoples to deal with the Indigenous issues in a more effective way. Another important matter is that it's important to position Indigenous people, to have a common voice as the Indigenous peoples of Latin America. It's difficult to achieve that. Sometimes we hear Indigenous peoples of Bolivia speaking, or Indigenous peoples of Africa or Venezuela, whereas in fact when regions come together, when organizations from different regions come together, they have a much greater voice as representing Indigenous peoples. Now, here we have different indigenous organizations, members of the platform. We have the coordinator, Humberto Tavo, that represents indigenous organizations of the Amazon Basin, which is also part of the platform. And they are leading this process, this platform, and they have sought the support of the FAO to push this process forward. Humberto, perhaps you can give us his point of view, because I think it's very important to listen and to hear what the indigenous peoples are saying and what they think of the platform. Don Humberto, maybe you can say a few words. Madam Alberta.
Okay. Yes. You raise your hands. Yes.
Brother Mr. Albert. Thank you. I think within the different states around the world, there are different levels of authority of government, and communication has always been essential in each one of these levels of power. However, that being said, for indigenous peoples, this is a vacuum, really. Because many of the actions that we carry out as indigenous peoples are not very well known. Indigenous peoples, we don't have much access to the media, to communication. Indigenous peoples have been marginalized from all of the different organizations, and I think from within, even at the UN and FAO, these organizations should have mechanisms to enable indigenous peoples to demonstrate the actions and activities that they have undertaken, because indigenous peoples do contribute to design mechanisms and policies that make it possible to structure and develop each one of the states. And indigenous peoples are often seen as actors who complicate the development of each one of our countries. And this is based on that what we have tried to do is to see how we can, in fact, become empowered and to have a right to communication and to express our view freely and our position. And so indigenous organizations have sought to develop a mechanism to allow indigenous peoples to have access to communication. And this is only a beginning of many activities that we're currently developing. I think it's also important to mention that the indigenous peoples have made a contribution in developing a mechanism have access to communication. The first and foremost, this should come from indigenous peoples themselves, these efforts. Another risk that we see is that many institutions that are supposedly supporting indigenous peoples, in fact, appropriate the results of the work of indigenous peoples, which is meant mainly for indigenous people. I would like to recommend that this topic be perhaps discussed at greater length, because this is really a beginning of a process, and we would urge the indigenous movement to join our efforts in order to defend the rights of indigenous peoples. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so to continue, I think the key proposal there is perhaps to consider the creation of some kind of mechanism and maybe to consider the UN Permanent Forum to consider the possibility of having a focal point to address communication issues for indigenous peoples that enable indigenous peoples to develop their own voice and to empower themselves, and inviting other UN agencies to be part of this. Okay, to continue, the next theme had to do with how are land resources, food security, and food sovereignty interlinked, and what is FAO's perspective on this issue, and how do we engage indigenous peoples in this issue? For FAO, land is food. Without access to resources, critical resources, one cannot produce food. If you can't produce, you can also gain access through income, through jobs. There are other means. But for rural peoples, access to land is critical. And it's not just an economic resource. It's for indigenous peoples, it's part of identity. It's part of your spirituality. It's where your ancestors are. It's the home of future generations. So it's critical even to cultural survival. One of the examples I would like to give that we think is really innovative is work that's being done to support delimitation of customary territories. And work has been done in Angola among the San. It's here in this CD-ROM. The first step, and this sort of typifies the relationship between food security, food sovereignty, and land. The first step was to work with indigenous communities to understand the history of settlement in the area. Who were the first people? How did people come afterwards? What was the negotiation process? It's not just today. It's a long history, and you have to understand that. Secondly, it was to look at questions of social hierarchy and the stakeholder roles and the differences in power. And then being very straightforward about this, because it's a negotiated issue. Territories are shared. The third part had to do with working with indigenous communities to define the boundaries of the land and to reach consensus with the neighboring communities about where those boundaries were. The fourth part, then, was in getting the national government to recognize that territory and to ensure that the authorities of that territory were officially recognized as the people with whom negotiations need to take place, not the governments, the decentralized authorities, the ones who know about the land and how it's managed. That's just one example. We do this in many, many other countries now in Southern Africa. The San example is the key indigenous example we can share, but it's a work in progress, and there are some very good principles in there. And what we would like to do is invite you, because you've asked one of the questions, what can we do with indigenous peoples? We've got a set of principles that came from that experience, and we would invite your views on these. We have copies of them that we would like to share, and begin a process of discussion with you and dialogue and how to go about doing this more systematically with indigenous communities in other parts of the world. Okay. On the question...
Eve, can I please ask you to stop there first so that we can also hear the indigenous people and the government who would like to ask a question. Then you can pick it up from there. Please. Just think of where you stopped, and then you can pick it up after we call the speakers. Okay, so I'd like now to... of course, remind again the speakers that this is really a dialogue, so you should raise questions more than talk about a situation. So I'd like to ask first Jacqueline Carino, who will speak on behalf of the Asia Indigenous Peoples Caucus. Then after her, Ricardo Miranda from the Sindical Unica de Trabajadores. You have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Indigenous peoples' organizations in Asia call the urgent attention of the Food and Agriculture Organization to policies and programs that not only threaten indigenous peoples' food security, but have caused indigenous peoples' food insecurity in the first place. We refer here and question policies that encourage more industrialization of agriculture, more use of chemical fertilizers, pesticides, and GMOs, more green revolution, monoculture and corporate agriculture, more liberalization of trade and investment. Such programs have miserably failed to uplift indigenous peoples and stave off hunger. They have degraded the environment and forests, decreased agrobiodiversity, undermined small-scale farming, diverted land use to cash crops and agrofuels, and destroyed the self-sufficiency of small indigenous farmers. We would also like to question the seeming reluctance of the FAO and states to listen to the voices of grassroots indigenous peoples organizations, as seen in the dwindling support for the participation of grassroots movements in important international forums on food. For example, social movements, including indigenous peoples, through the International Planning Committee in Asia, were denied greater representation at the FAO Asia Regional Conference in Bangkok last March due to supposed lack of funds. We therefore forward the following recommendations to the FAO. One, to ensure the respect of the UN Declaration on Indigenous Peoples in all its programs and activities in relating to Indigenous Peoples, in particular, implement the provisions for free, prior, and informed consent. Two, we urge you to support small-scale, sustainable, and traditional agriculture and give due credit and support for Indigenous knowledge and practices of Indigenous Peoples which provide valuable alternatives that could mitigate the present food crisis. Three, particularly in Cambodia, to ensure the Cambodian National Forestry Program, which is funded by FAO, that uses approaches suited to the situation where the forests of the country are the resources of the people's daily lives and where the model of state-led forest management has been a disaster. Four, ensure Indigenous peoples' participation in key national, regional, and international forums that could impact on their food security, and to develop an Indigenous peoples' policy within the FAO that is consistent with the provisions of the UN Declaration. And fifth, to establish partnerships with Indigenous organizations in the development of programs and projects addressing Indigenous peoples' issues related to food security and sustainable agricultural practices. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jacqueline Carino from the Asia Indigenous Peoples Caucus. I call now on Ricardo Miranda, who is from the Confederación Sindical Única de Trabajadores Campesinos de Bolivia. Yeah, you have the floor, sir.
Thank you very much. Well, with respect to agriculture and food security and food sovereignty. Now, you all know very well that in Bolivia we're experiencing change, a process of change that reflects the political situation in our country and policies that have been adopted by the state. And sometimes we have problems with agricultural production when you have people trying to speculate on with foodstuffs and food security and sovereignty, of course, are essential. And we're developing a strategy, a program for agricultural production. And this is based on the participation of indigenous peoples from different parts of Bolivia. And this program intends to declare year 2010 as the year for environmental agricultural production and agricultural sovereignty in Bolivia, so that the indigenous peoples and organizations of indigenous farmers of the different regions of Bolivia. The idea is for us to have a discussion, to be involved in the debate on forestation, irrigation, soil improvement, and different other topics. And so we are going to request the various states and the sectors represented here to assist us to provide us support. This is a very important initiative for Bolivia because we, the indigenous peoples, have been migrating towards cities, and so there's a considerable need to slow down this migration and to combat against a lack of food production. And so we are going to work hard, and again, you reiterate, 2010 will be a year of environmental food production and food sovereignty. Now, furthermore, we would like to propose that all the governments and member states and UN agencies guarantee plans and policies of social and cultural development that are sustainable to and that reflect the needs of indigenous peoples and living in rural areas, and that they reflect the needs in all the different plans and strategies, and specifically in Bolivia, so as that we don't suffer from the speculators who gouge prices for foodstuffs And sometimes when that happens in Bolivia, people blame our president Evo Morales, our brother Evo Morales, and that is wrong. And so for all this, we are trying to plan for these changes, and we're trying to do this by declaring this 2010 as the year, as I told you, of environmental and protection. And again, we urge all organizations and states to assist us. I mean, we can't simply keep on having sterile discussions. We need to join our efforts. Thank you very much.
Our friend from Ricardo Miranda from the Confederacion Sindical. Now I call on the representative of government, Denmark, Mr. Andreas Balzer Jorgensen. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. FAO should be congratulated with the emerging policy and that it will be sent for consultation with indigenous peoples' organizations. FAO should also be complimented on the very specific description on the limitations and constraints the organization is facing in ensuring a proper inclusion of indigenous peoples' issues in the work. It's written in the report that there's no overall framework for action because member governments have not requested an explicit focus on indigenous issues. I will, of course, follow up this in our formal contacts with Rome, with FAO in Rome. FAO deserves, in honest terms, or describes in honest terms, that there is some institutional resistance within the organization. We would like to ask FAO how this institutional resistance can be reversed. The report focuses on Latin America, where the identification of indigenous peoples has been fairly straightforward. Little is written on the other continents. Is that because there are few projects elsewhere? Even in Latin America, the projects designed for indigenous peoples and involving indigenous peoples are very small and relatively few, taking FAO size into consideration. We would like to see a mainstreaming policy addressing indigenous issues in all areas where indigenous peoples are found. Will such a mainstreaming be part of the new strategy? When we see the relation between livelihood and indigenous peoples, the report is written in quite general terms. Looking at a report from FAO on indigenous peoples, I really miss the word pastoralists and pastoralism. In many countries in Africa, pastoralists constitute large groups of indigenous peoples, and FAO should be the organization supporting these peoples in sustaining their livelihoods. Is FAO planning to have special projects and programs for pastoralists and accommodating pastoralists in existing programs? FAO is congratulated for undertaking research on indigenous issues. We will propose that the subjects for the research are defined with participation of indigenous peoples and undertaken also with participation of indigenous researchers to ensure capacity building and proper delivery of the research results. As a final question, I would like to hear how FAO will apply free, prior and informed consent where projects and activities are implemented in areas with indigenous populations. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anders Jorgensen from the government of Denmark. Now I'd like to give the floor to another government, Mr. Freddy Mamani, on behalf of the observer government of Bolivia. You have the floor, sir.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you, Sister Chairman. Basically, Bolivia has implemented a national plan for productive development for indigenous sovereign free production. And in this context, the national plan has been developed jointly with the associations of indigenous peoples. And it's a plan which provides for productive economic transformation. And in this context, I'd like the UN systems agencies to be able to support us and to incorporate this plan into their guidelines. It's a plan which is crucial if we are to develop the new constitution of the state. which is basically recovering the commanding heights of the economy and is trying to deal with the food crisis in our country. And in this context, the FAO and the various bodies involved in sustainable production and those involved with the environment are going to be the ones most keenly involved in the work we're doing and who can assist us in this process in the UN system. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mamani. I call now on Saul Vicente Vasquez from the International Indian Treaty Council. You have the floor, sir.
Muchas gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you, madam. This is the first time I've spoken at this meeting, and I'd like to endorse the congratulations expressed to you on your election as chair. May I now address the representative of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations through a document which we've signed as representatives of the indigenous peoples and organizations of indigenous people from various regions of the world, concerned by the effects which world climate change is causing to our territories and lands, jeopardizing the survival of our peoples. We took part on the 16th and 17th of May of 2009 in the Conclave of Indigenous Peoples here in New York prior to this eighth session. At that meeting, we agreed on a number of recommendations to be submitted to the Permanent Forum, including backing the Anchorage Declaration on Climate Change, in particular the request to the FAO to establish a working group of indigenous peoples on climate change and food safety and security. This is in something which we'd say in response to the recent speaker who said we need some sort of mechanism for relations between FAO and indigenous peoples. And because of this, the indigenous peoples that backed this letter requested, or this charter, requested that you ensure that the FAO support the organization and implementation of a World Summit of Indigenous Peoples held in 2010, so that the FAO can endorse the establishment of this working group. We, for our part, express our interest in participating in this endeavor and our commitment to work jointly with the FAO to carry it through. We'd like to ask whether you've received this formal letter sent by 66 organizations of indigenous people here in this room, and have you forwarded it to Jacques Diouf, the Director General of the FAO, or will you do so when you return to the FAO headquarters? The second letter. The second point is that we think that in November it's very likely that the FAO is going to hold a world summit on food, and we'd like to ask whether there might be some forum at that summit for the indigenous peoples to discuss food issues and be involved in a piloting committee or steering committee so that that meeting can be held. And lastly, madam, on the part of the International Council of Indian Treaties, we'd like to express our wish to be involved in the development of indicators on food security and food sovereignty. The result of the first trial phase of these cultural indicators was submitted in our parallel event yesterday, and we were grateful for the FAO in participating in this. And there was a comprehensive report submitted to the Secretariat of the UN Permanent Forum. We've always kept a permanent forum abreast of each and every stage of the development of cultural indicators in conjunction with the development of well-being or welfare indicators. We've also established a commitment to the last session of the permanent forum to share the results of the first year of the work of the process of training in the communities. Consequently, we'd be enormously grateful if the report of this eighth session were to acknowledge this implementation and the importance of this instrument for the indigenous peoples in assessing and responding to current challenges, threats, or impacts to their food security and sovereignty. We'd be very grateful to have this opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'd call now on Edwin Matahil Mual from Tribal Link. No, he's not here. Yeah, okay, you you raise your hand and you press your button.
Okay.
Very brief, please. We have very few minutes left.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We respect the decision of Madam Chair, and we therefore submit the joint statement on behalf of the participants of the Project Access Global Capacity to the Secretariat. In addition, we urgently propose the following two recommendations to the 8 sessions of the Permanent Forum and to the United Nations agencies present in this dialogue. First, we recognize the presence of FAO and all the United Nations agencies who are engaged in this dialogue, and we strongly urge and encourage them to continue this critically important dialogue in further sessions. Secondly, we request the United Nations Permanent Forum to address indigenous people's food security and right to food and food sovereign as a special theme and focus of discussion at one of its upcoming sessions to ensure survival of indigenous peoples around the world. In conclusion, Madam Chair, we request the Permanent Forum to inform United Nations bodies and agencies, including the Security Council, of the immediate critical threat to the human rights and the lives of our indigenous peoples and all the peoples of the world. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I see the flag of my colleague earlier, Carlos Mabane. Are you going to ask a question? Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam. Firstly, I'd like to thank the Food and Agriculture Organization and highlight the work which is being developed in my country. For the Pakakasu Nation, I'd like to express thanks. And the FAO is doing some very interesting work related to food sovereignty and how to tackle the effects of climate change. This is an aspect which I think we need to highlight. It's obviously very localized work. It's not one of major regional impact. But the quest for good practices for traditional agriculture and how to deal with the effects of climate change, how to tackle the risks stemming from climate change, all of this can have a knock-on effect elsewhere. And in this same perspective, we welcome the sensitivity of the FAO to these issues. We'd like to ask whether the FAO can support more resolutely the indigenous lands and territories, because if the lands and territories are jeopardized by extracting industries or other types of companies, then it's very difficult to talk about food security for the indigenous peoples. Furthermore, bearing in mind as well this sensitivity and the need to implement the Declaration of the United Nations on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, I'd like to know if the FAO is going to work with the traditional governments of indigenous peoples directly. In my village, for example, we have the FAO working with the partners of the indigenous peoples. I wonder whether that could be made widespread practice elsewhere. It's a way of strengthening the local indigenous authorities in their forms of traditional governance. And lastly, I wonder if the FAO could work on cooperation with respect to land management issues. The indigenous territories have been disrupted by colonization processes, and the indigenous peoples, therefore, need maps of the resources which they have within those territories. And they need to have some mapping of the effects of climate change so that they can deal with those issues. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carlos Mamani. I'd like now to call on the last two in my list who are, but they will be speaking very briefly because we need to listen to the response. And I call on Wilton Littlechild to take the floor on behalf of the Assembly of First Nations. You have the floor.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I will go right to the questions. Further to the Honorable Member of the Forum, Ms. Tanya Ganella-Frischner's questions. I have two. One, how is FAO addressing the North-South situation, in particular indigenous rural areas? For example, we have ongoing issues where we have ranching as a way of life. You're no doubt aware of the ongoing efforts in this area. And secondly, a related issue, an importantly related issue, currently we have challenges regarding the treaty and human rights to water. So we'd be interested in FAO's response. And secondly, how does FAO work with other agencies and bodies related to conservation and preservation of our ecohabitat? For instance, in the boreal forests and off our coastal waterways, to ensure food sovereignty, food security, and advancement of our cultural, economic, and spiritual practices related to local and traditional food production practices. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The last one is her F. Angel of the Shi clan of the Yamasee Native American Moors, but I'd like her to ask a question and not make a statement. Is she in the room? No, she's not in the room. Okay, I'll ask Hassan, my colleague Hassan Edbal Hassan, to also ask a question, and then we'll move on to the FAO.
I would like, in the outset, to thank all the speakers from the FAO, and in particular, I thank them for the concept that they provided us with about agriculture as a broad-ranged concept that comprises all activities related to agriculture and nature and all forms of life that depends on nature, which is something extremely important for the indigenous peoples. Two main points I would like to raise. I think that the protection of the food security of indigenous people requires work by the FAO to work on protecting the rights of these peoples at the realistic level when it comes to lands, resources, water, in the wide range. And this also requires governments to work on securing sovereignty to the indigenous peoples on their lands and natural resources to secure safety and security for the whole world, because the climate changes that are taking place now and affecting the whole world, and they affect the whole world, they affect even more the indigenous peoples for a different reason, namely that all policies, government policies in the world, deprive these peoples from their resources, from their authority, from their food security, all these peoples before these new formations of states had their own food security, food sufficiency, but now they depend on other countries. And the other points that the other point I would like to raise is that several projects provided by international organizations such as yours provide assistance and support to the indigenous peoples, but only partially. And at the same time, they put several mega projects on their lands and territories that damage everything, and the indigenous women and children more than anybody else. I wonder if before the declaration was adopted, it was acceptable for international organizations to give some attention or no attention to the indigenous peoples. But I think that after the declaration was adopted, it's necessary for the international organizations such as yours to create a certain division that's totally dedicated to the indigenous peoples on the international level, to have units dedicated to the indigenous peoples at the different levels, including the national one. And I would like to know if you really consider establishing a special unit dedicated to this purpose, because food security and food sovereignty for the indigenous peoples requires further attention on your part. Thank you.
I'd like to turn now to the FAO colleagues. They would like to respond. You don't have to respond to everything. You can choose what you would like to respond to, because we have time limitations. You have the floor, Eve.
First of all, I would like to thank you sincerely for the very thoughtful input that you've provided. These questions are not easy questions to answer. They require a great deal of thought from us, and I don't want to give some quick answer that doesn't necessarily reflect the complexity of the points that you're raising. So I will do my best to respond to some, and I have recorded as carefully as possible, both my colleague and I, the other ones, and we're available to you after this session to discuss them in further detail. On the question of what needs to happen and what are the obstacles that we're facing in implementing a policy for Indigenous peoples and implementing the UN Declaration in the context of FAO. The first one is the fact that as a specialized agency, we respond to our member governments, and the member governments in our governing body are ministries of agriculture, ministries of forestry, ministries of fisheries, ministries of land. The first step is to ensure that those government representatives are informed about the declaration and about the UNDG guidelines and about the role that they as governments and FAO as an intergovernmental agency has in helping to implement these guidelines. And we would request your partnership in helping to make this happen. A second key constraint we're facing is awareness. Awareness within FAO and awareness in country. And I would just like to highlight, in a recent review of work, we found, we've been trying to actually do training in the decentralized offices about the declaration and about the UNDG guidelines. And we've extended it not just to FAO's decentralized offices, but also to governments and other stakeholders in country. We found that in this training in Guatemala, only one participant was familiar with the guidelines. In Mexico, Ecuador, Honduras, El Salvador, and Nicaragua, participants were not familiar with the guidelines or with the declaration. And this included indigenous organizations. So there's an enormous amount of work that needs to be done by all of us to raise awareness at multiple levels. We would request, again, your help. All of us have to do this, and we ourselves within FAO would like this to be part of our strategy following the adaptation. The reason I talk about governments, though, I just want to emphasize, we welcome, for example, Denmark's suggestion of going back to the permanent representations in Rome and making sure that this is raised. Those of you, we welcome your efforts to go to the FAO representations in your countries and to talk to your governments and encourage them to raise this. If governments raise it, we can address it. The adoption of the policy itself, we first welcome your comments on the policy. It's not completely finalized. So if you have inputs to that, please provide them. But there's still a risk that it will not be cleared within FAO and it may not be approved by our government. So we need you to help this to happen. Now, to address some of the other questions, there have been so many. Let me see. We take note of the issue that some of the projects and programs that FAO supports emphasize intensification. And there's an increasing drive towards looking at sustainable intensification as opposed to just intensification. But the fact is that there are different schools of thought within FAO. There are those who promote more intensive input, intensive approaches, and there are those who support agroecological, low-input approaches that many believe are more appropriate for indigenous communities and for fragile ecosystems. These are two sort of competing ideologies that continue to exist and will continue to exist. I think there is recognition that the agroecological approaches are much more appropriate for indigenous communities. And there is a strong group of people who believe in this, and the globally important agricultural heritage systems is just one example. So I can't say that it... I think we can just go back with the message that this is the approach that has resounded more solidly here. And I've taken note of all of the specific comments relating to Cambodia and the National Forest Program, the importance of small-scale traditional farming, the issues of ensuring indigenous people's participation in FAO meetings and governing bodies. We recognize that recently there's been a bit of a change, not necessarily positive in this regard. FAO has had a lot of change in its management structure recently, connected with the reform process. And we take note of this in connection to the point about a possible World Food Summit taking place later this year. This is one of the items that may be discussed by governments in June. We would know in June if that summit is likely to happen. If it is, we take your point that there should be an indigenous forum and a clear mechanism for indigenous inputs into this, and we would be happy to propose this to our management, and we welcome the petition as well that you have put forward. With regards to this petition on the Anchorage Declaration, the idea of having a focal point on the indigenous people side who can help to channel and coordinate inputs, and on our side, putting together a task force to address the climate change conditions and implications for indigenous peoples, I think that's a very good suggestion. We'd like to take that on board, and maybe with a view of, in the long run, possibly expanding that, not just to look at climate change, so let's start with climate change, but maybe expanding it to having a kind of indigenous reference group for the work of FAO in food and agriculture. Okay, that's a possible longer-term vision, but let us start with the concrete on climate change and see how that can move forward. In connection to the declaration in 2010 of Bolivia on, again, emphasizing the importance of agroecological approaches, we think this is an appealing idea, and we commend you in putting it forward as something that that Bolivia might be able to focus on in 2010. Let's see. Yeah, the question of institutional resistance, I think I've addressed that, connected to government awareness and awareness within the organization, and we would need to do some capacity building to overcome it. On the question of pastoralists and pastoralism, FAO does actually have quite a bit of work with pastoralist communities. There was a whole program in Eastern and Southern Africa looking at local indigenous knowledge systems that had a strong pastoral component. We've been doing work increasingly with pastoralists in supporting farmer field school approaches, but engaging pastoralists in these field schools, which are experiential learning approaches, and even in trying to raise sensitivity to people along the value chains about the perspectives that pastoralist communities and pastoralist producers have. Another key area where pastoralist communities have played an important role has been in the work on animal genetic resources and the whole, not just the declaration, but also the framework for action on animal genetic resources. None of that could have been done without pastoralists who play the key role in domesticating breeds and in maintaining animal genetic resources worldwide. There was a question on free prior informed consent and how we plan to implement it. There are some cases where we currently use it and have used it very successfully in relation to the study on indigenous food systems. It was really a model of how that can be done in the research field. And this was done in close collaboration with the whole free prior informed consent in writing in translating into local languages. There are some places, I think in the Pacific, the Code of Conduct for Responsible Fisheries has been translated into local languages as well, in I think 8 different local languages. But we still have a long way to go. It's not consistently integrated yet, and I think this would be a key part to a strategy that would follow the policy. And we would, again, need your help in ensuring that this is respected. It's a very good, concrete thing, and it will require a lot of work to ensure that it's respected, given the fact that there's so many different layers of people involved. On the question of, the north and the south and ranching and water, FAO has a big program in supporting water, the Water Forum, and issues of transboundary water, and the questions of water quality. Much of it is connected to water use in agriculture as opposed to consumption, even though water is the first food and is critical for food security. As I said before, the concentration of our work is in developing countries, but some of the international instruments we develop are equally valid in northern countries, and I think that the right to food guidelines are especially important. Please let me just draw your attention to a series of instruments that we have that are specifically oriented towards the right to food for indigenous peoples, and there's guidelines that were in the back that are, it's a way of screening these guidelines and helping you to understand how you can use them to ensure your rights. And I think that this is, it from the very beginning, I think it was the International Indian Treaty Council who played a role in the actual development of the voluntary guidelines for right to food, which was approved by consensus of all governments. And there's a program now to implement this. It can only be done effectively with civil society as key partners, and with indigenous peoples as key partners. We need to honor the right to food, your right to food. So please take a look. There's this and there's another document that can help support that. On connection to the protection of rights of people to land, resources, and water, and the whole point that indigenous peoples are more affected by climate change, and to systematize the protection of rights of people to land, we know this is a highly sensitive issue. We acknowledge the importance of traditional territories for indigenous peoples. Our key partners are governments. So it is still a bit of a dilemma. It depends on how much governments are ready and open to revising national legislation in ways that can increasingly acknowledge customary territories. But there are countries in Africa where there's very progressive legislation in place and where a land tax system is being put in place that protects poor people and works against large landholders who don't necessarily utilize their land effectively, but also allows for pastoral systems which are extensive and not where you need large holdings, but are where it's not going to be intensively managed. So there's some very interesting cases in existence that could be used and scaled up. So we would appreciate your inputs into those principles that I shared with you. Have I missed anything, Regina?
The last one, Hassan's comments.
On
if we are willing to establish a unit.
Oh, on the question of whether we're willing to establish a unit to focus on indigenous issues. It is a very interesting question. We have a focal point, one, plus a set of committed individuals, maybe about 20 people in different technical departments who for years have been working on this because they believe in it, and it's never been formally recognized, but it's working because they believe in it. We can put the proposal forward. My sense is that it is unlikely to be accepted, primarily because we are undergoing a reform and resources are tight. But if we can deal with it as a dimension of social inclusion that's critical for achieving food security, I mean, one seventh of the rural poor are indigenous peoples. That is not a small number. And that means that a more coherent program for doing this. I think that realistically what we might be able to do is try to include within the new strategic framework a unit result which is specifically associated with Indigenous peoples, which we could hold ourselves accountable for and which governments would be asking our progress in. And that could tap into expertise across the House, which might be more useful. Because you want to be able to benefit from the richness of expertise, and one of the problems with creating a division is that sometimes it divides instead of builds. So we need to think creatively about how to do this, and I again would welcome your views. And thank you so much for these I haven't done honor.
No, that's okay if you haven't answered everything, because you need to. You can send to us also some of the answers, because our two colleagues are going to also make their closing statements on this.
I know that the Francophone Africa group on communications for development are very interested in making a statement about this, and I don't know if they may if they may have the floor.
We have the Office of the High Commissioner coming next. So
okay, so we are available after the session for anyone interested in hearing more about that. And we will maybe meet out just outside the door and follow up there. Thank you again for your patience. Thank you so much to all of you for coming and for providing us with your brilliant insight.
Thank you very much, Eve and Regina. You're not going to leave yet, because I'd like my two colleagues to say their concluding statements, Tanya Gunyela Frischner, and after her, Elisa Kankimolo. Tanya, you have the floor.
My colleague, Madam Kenki, and I have decided that we would make a one-minute statement each, because time is of the essence right now. We would like to thoroughly thank our colleagues from FAO for their very thorough, well-presented, and comprehensive report. It has been a pleasure listening to them, and please accept our deep appreciation. We also appreciate the governments of Denmark and Bolivia for their comments, and also for all of the Indigenous delegates who have spoken. Quite quickly, Madam Chair, in reference to RED, we would have liked to have been able to have time to discuss the effect that transnational industries and other businesses have had on Indigenous communities, their involvement, their participation, and their contribution to the negative effects on our communities regarding REDS. The next point that we'd like to make is that in terms of land, we were happy to hear from Madame Crowley when she stated that land is food and land is life in terms of our identity. Certainly, FAO understands the very crux and foundation of what Indigenous peoples are all about. Regarding our right to food and for food sovereignty, we are very happy to hear that your work with the International Indian Treaty Council led to that report on the right to food and that statement and that report. But of course, we would also like to state that there needs to be further discussion on genetically modified organisms, chemical and other artificially manufactured inputs in food production, especially as they relate to Indigenous peoples. We would like to support the proposal that was brought forward by Indigenous delegates in terms of a unit in the future that would respond to Indigenous peoples, focus on our issues within FAO, and we would like very much for governments to support this. And we would also like, and I would say for myself, I would endorse that FAO support the organization and holding of a World Summit of Indigenous Peoples to be held during the year 2010, so that with the endorsement of FAO, this working group will be established. Thank you very much, representatives from FAO, for your attention. Madam Chair.
Elisa?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Solo dos puntos.
Just two final points. I would like if you take note that the indigenous people cannot commit themselves to a process until they fully involved in. So any initiative that refers to this mechanism should ensure the participation of indigenous peoples, providing information on the mechanism and strengthening the capacity of indigenous peoples to get involved and to be active beneficiaries of the process. Secondly, support to the development of public policies and funding of programs and projects should be coordinated with indigenous peoples. I think these two considerations are very important, given that these are very important and innovative areas. There are many resources that are being made available for this mechanism, and this will be finalized and implemented. There's no doubt about that. But what's important, as indigenous peoples have stated, the mechanism will emerge with us or without us, but we want to be a part of the solution. We want to be involved in developing and implementing it. Thank you very much for accepting the invitation of the forum, and we hope that in the future we will work in a coordinated fashion, because we want to be part of this process. We, the indigenous people, we want to be part of this process and support the FAO in implementing this major initiative, the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I would like to thank also Eve Crowley, Regina Loeb, and Ileana Rojas de Casanova for the participation here in our dialogue with the FAO. And we will get back to you also with some of our concluding remarks. Thank you so much, and we wish you all the luck in pursuing all the programs you want to develop for and with indigenous peoples. Thank you, and I would like now to make an announcement before I call on Timur, on Auntie. The document on item 3, draft recommendations, are ready. This is the L3 paper, so for those who would like to take a look at those, you can already get them from the Documentation Center, L2. Now I would like to please ask Mr. Auntie Kirby, who is the coordinator of the Minorities and Indigenous Peoples Unit of the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, to come into the podium, because we would like to start immediately with the dialogue with the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights. So, if we can ask our FAO colleagues to make way for Auntie Kirby. Thank you very much. Okay, thank you very much. We will immediately proceed now to our colleague, Auntie Kirby, who is from the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights, and we'd like to give him the floor for his introductory remarks, and after that we will open the floor for our colleagues who have developed the questions for him. So you have the floor, Auntie.
Peoples, distinguished representatives of member states, ladies and gentlemen, I would like to start by congratulating you, Madam Chair, on your election as the chairperson of the Permanent Forum, and by thanking the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues for inviting the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights to take part in this important in-depth dialogue. We believe that this is an excellent initiative that will undoubtedly enable us to strengthen further our partnership, enhance awareness about activities of UN agencies, and open up new opportunities for the forum to provide input to our activities and help us further develop our work. All this will take us towards our common goal of ensuring promotion and protection of the rights of indigenous peoples. As you all know, the OHCHR has a long and distinguished record in advancing the rights of indigenous peoples. We have supported standard setting, monitoring, and implementation of the rights of indigenous peoples through different means. The office has, for example, serviced the Working Group on Indigenous Populations and now the Expert Mechanism on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the Intersessional Working Group on the Draft Declaration, assisted the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms of Indigenous People, supported a range of human rights treaty bodies, trained Indigenous fellows, and of course implemented through our field presences numerous concrete country-specific activities benefiting Indigenous peoples and advancing their rights. While we are proud of this record, the office is committed to making our work in this field even stronger, and it has this year been able to somewhat increase resources devoted to the protection of indigenous peoples. In terms of the focus of the office, we have, just like many of our partners here, entered a new era, brought about, of course, by the adoption of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in September 2007. This landmark achievement is having a major impact on the design and focus of the work of the office in the field of the protection of the rights of indigenous peoples. And while the adoption per se was and is rightly celebrated, there is no scope for complacency here. We all know that as we speak here today, human rights of indigenous peoples are being violated in many parts of the world. With this in mind, we need to strengthen further our activities on indigenous peoples to make sure that the adoption of the declaration yields concrete positive results for indigenous peoples and the rights stipulated in the declaration move from paper to practice. Indeed, since its adoption, the declaration has rapidly become our key tool and reference for the work devoted to indigenous peoples in line with Articles 41 and 42 of the declaration. Our written report submitted to this session of the forum contains details as to what this means in practical terms, but allow me to highlight some examples of our activities that are inspired and rooted in the declaration, the principles it contains. First of all, the office is playing an important role in the promotion of the declaration through the production of awareness-raising materials, guides and brochures, and through translation of relevant documents into indigenous languages. In addition, the office, often through its regional and country presences, has provided hands-on training not only for and with indigenous representatives and governmental representatives, but also for the UN staff and mechanisms. For example, we have organized staff training for UN staff working in the field in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, but more work of this type is needed in order to ensure that the principles contained in the declaration are felt at the country level. And often this type of work is carried out in cooperation with our partner agencies, such as UNDP, and ILO, and others, and often with input from the Permanent Forum and its secretariat. We have also, at the Office of the High Commissioner, briefed human rights treaty bodies on the content of the declaration. While such treaty bodies as the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination have for many years played close attention to indigenous people's concerns, the declaration can be a valuable additional reference in the work of treaty bodies, as was recently demonstrated by the Committee on the Rights of the Child, which explicitly referred to the declaration in its general comment number 11 on the rights of indigenous children, adopted in January 2009. The office also draws upon the declaration as it provides technical assistance to member states on issues pertaining to indigenous peoples. This has been the case, for example, in our contributions to the drafting of a law relating to indigenous peoples in the Republic of Congo. Furthermore, We are, as an office, highlighting the relevance of the declaration in our work carried out in related fields. As an example, I would like to mention that the office organized a specific event on the declaration in the context of the Durban Review Conference against racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerance. And in her contribution to the review conference, the High Commissioner for Human Rights hailed the adoption of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as a major achievement. I would also like to mention that we seek to step up our support for national human rights institutions that seek to promote the use of the Declaration in their important work at the country level. And once again, I would like to stress that many of our activities pertaining to the Declaration are organized in cooperation with our partner agencies. For example, we partnered with the UNDP to organize a regional dialogue on the Declaration earlier this year in Bangkok. And next month, our regional office is organizing, together with a number of partner agencies, a workshop on the Declaration for Central America in Nicaragua. Now, I would like to say a few words about new mechanisms within the human rights framework of the UN. Because in addition to having the Declaration as a new instrument to guide and inspire our work, there have been significant institutional developments that directly impact on our work and help us advance the rights of Indigenous peoples. These include, notably, the launch of the Expert Mechanism on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as a subsidiary body of the Human Rights Council of the United Nations. As explained yesterday by its Vice Chair, Jose Carlos Morales, the Expert Mechanism held its first meeting last year, and it is now working on its first thematic study devoted to the Indigenous people's right to education, to be submitted to the Human Rights Council later this year. As many of you know, the work of the Expert Mechanism will focus mainly on studies and research-based advice, and it thereby complements the very important work carried out by the Special Rapporteur on the situation of human rights and fundamental freedoms of Indigenous peoples. And Professor James Anaya yesterday introduced his current work to you yesterday. The Office of the High Commissioner is committed not only to ensuring full support to the Expert Mechanism and the Special Rapporteur, treaty bodies and other relevant mechanisms, but also facilitating excellent cooperation between various UN bodies dealing with human rights of Indigenous peoples, including, of course, the Permanent Forum. We have already seen this cooperation developing in practice with examples ranging from the forums and Special Rapporteur's active participation in the first session of the Expert Mechanism to the recent joint statement of the three mandates welcoming Australia's endorsement of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. With our colleagues in the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum, we stand ready to convene joint meetings between representatives of these bodies to further facilitate close contacts and cooperation. The Human Rights Council, with the support of the Office of the High Commissioner, also last year launched its Universal Periodic Review process, so-called UPR process. And I would like to say a few words about that, because as some of you know, the UPR involves a review of the human rights records of all 192 UN member states once every 4 years. And it is indeed important that the Indigenous peoples are actively using this mechanism, both in terms of providing input to it and in helping to make sure that the resulting recommendations are followed up. Some of the Indigenous representatives present here have already contributed to this process, helping to highlight Indigenous concerns in this context. And a number of resulting recommendations call for specific measures to advance rights of Indigenous peoples, and there are some explicit references to the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The Office of the High Commissioner has also facilitated the creation of other new human rights tools that, while not devoted exclusively to Indigenous peoples, are highly relevant in this context. These include the complaint mechanism contained in the new optional protocol to the Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights adopted by the General Assembly in December, which has substantial potential for Indigenous peoples as well. Madam Chair, let me now say a few words about the OHCHR's cooperation and contacts with the Permanent Forum. All recommendations that the Forum addresses to the office are considered very seriously, and they have, in a number of cases, prompted concrete, thematic, and other activities that remain part of our agenda today. As a way of example, I would like to mention that the office has carried out substantial work on the issue of indigenous peoples in voluntary isolation, in line with a recommendation made by the Forum. This ongoing work carried out in cooperation with IFGIA, IPES, and support of the Spanish Cooperation Agency is producing substantial guidance on the protection of the rights of isolated peoples. And we were pleased to see that many of you attended the side event devoted to this issue earlier today. Our work on extractive industries is another theme that follows on earlier recommendations by the Forum. And in this area, the latest event was workshop on natural resource companies, indigenous peoples, and human rights, setting a framework for consultation, benefit sharing, and dispute resolution, an event that was organized in Moscow in December with a view to producing guidelines on the issue. Bearing in mind that the Permanent Forum has strong expertise on these themes, it is important that we cooperate in the implementation of our activities. And I'm pleased to note that in both processes that I mentioned, systematic processes I mentioned, members of the Forum have made substantial contributions for which we are grateful. Another substantial means of interacting with the Forum is the Indigenous Voluntary Fund, which the Office of the High Commissioner administers under guidance from its board. As you know, the fund provides travel grants that allowed more than 60 Indigenous representatives to attend the present session of the Forum, and it will enable many Indigenous representatives to take part in the next meeting of the expert mechanism on the rights of indigenous peoples. As mentioned by the chair of the board yesterday, by Ms. Dale Sambo-Doro, while the number of applications has continued to grow, our challenge is to reverse the current trend of decreases in voluntary contributions in order to enable the fund to continue to provide support for many committed applicants. In terms of the cooperation, I would also like to emphasize that at the secretariat level, we are actively cooperating with our colleagues in the secretariat of the Permanent Forum. This happens regularly in the context of the interagency support group of indigenous peoples, which also involves a number of other key agencies. But there are also frequent bilateral contacts, exchanges of information, and substantial input to each other's activities. And we are committed to further strengthening this excellent cooperation with our colleagues. And I know the same commitment is there also in the Secretariat of the Forum. We all have limited resources, and through joint efforts, we can maximize our combined impact. Let me finally say a few words about the participation of indigenous peoples in our activities. While the Office of the High Commissioner and others we are constantly stressing to the governments the importance of ensuring participation of indigenous peoples in decision-making, we must remember that it is equally important that we practice what we preach and see to it that our processes and activities involve substantial participation by indigenous peoples. With regard to certain key bodies within the Office of the High Commissioner or serviced by the Office of the High Commissioner, such as the expert mechanism and the board of the Voluntary Fund, this participation is ensured through their indigenous membership. But in addition to activities in Geneva, we are also taking measures to ensure that there is continuous dialogue with indigenous peoples at the country and regional level and as supporting mechanisms to help achieve this. We also seek to ensure that our own capacity building efforts contribute to the participation of indigenous peoples, not only at the country level, but also in our own activities. In this respect, I would like to highlight our Indigenous Fellowship Program, which has not only bolstered human rights expertise of Indigenous activists, but also resulted in a wide alumni network of Indigenous activists that now gives us guidance, for example, in the selection of new Indigenous Fellows. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to conclude by emphasizing that the Office of the High Commissioner remains strongly committed to the advancement of the rights of indigenous peoples and looks forward to expanding and strengthening its activities further, including in terms of helping to ensure concrete follow-up to recommendations and advice that results from the work of the special rapporteurs, treaty bodies, UPR expert mechanisms, and other key bodies, including, of course, the Permanent Forum. I look forward to your comments and proposals on how we can together pursue this goal and take further decisive steps in our common efforts to ensure full protection of the rights of indigenous peoples. Thank you very much for your attention.
I would like to thank very warmly the representative from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mr. Korkivi, for his excellent presentation, and also to identify what he mentioned earlier, the support that we receive from and have received for a very long time from the Voluntary Fund. Two of the representatives are here, one Mr. Kenneth Deer and Mr. I shouldn't say Mr., I'm sorry. Madam Dali Sambo, she was here earlier. I'm not too sure if she's in the room, but I'd like to express our appreciation for their work, so thank you very much. Right now, I'd like to open the floor to our colleagues from the Permanent Forum, who are the focal points for the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights on this particular issue, and which particular member would like to take the floor first? Mr. Clavera? Mr. Clavera, you have the floor, sir.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you. Between the written report and the verbal report, many things have been covered, and indeed many of the questions which I wanted to ask have been answered in advance. But I wanted to speak with what was virtually the last point in the oral statement. I think it's very important that in this new era, that is the era of the declaration, emphasis be placed on the participation of the indigenous peoples, which we require of states. And it's a requirement which needs to be met by the international organizations as well. So my question is, how can we step up this participation, this involvement of the indigenous? Are we going to consolidate the practice? Of course, it's going to depend on the Council of Human Rights, but the High Commissioner does have his own piece to say. Are we going to consolidate the practice of appointing indigenous experts to the expert panels? This may not have been spelled out yet, but I think it's important for this practice to be consolidated. And if there is such a plan, then how can we bolster indigenous participation before the experts' mechanism? And also, this applies to methods of communication between the indigenous communities and the special rapporteur and so on. Coming now to other questions which I was going to ask, I'd like to make some references to practices and methods of work and plans which we have for the future and the possibilities we have before us. As regards practices, first of all, is there any method, standard, ordinary, regular method in the Office of the High Commissioner for remaining constantly in a position where information is provided to all the human rights mechanisms of the United Nations on all of the reports which are going to be produced and which would be of interest to the indigenous peoples with respect to activities, for example, the visits of the special rapporteur and not just the reports which emerge from them. I'm thinking in particular of the human rights treaty bodies and committees. To what extent are they kept abreast of new developments which are of concern to the indigenous peoples, especially in the light of the declaration? And I would add to this question with the following. The Office of the High Commissioner has some involvement on the question of the Committee on the Rights of the Child, which has adopted a new stance on indigenous children. And I think other treaty bodies may have been less keen or less eager in this. How can we ensure that there is more resolute adoption of this new stance, this new vision, taking on board indigenous concerns in the treaty human rights treaty bodies? And then coming to questions of practices, reference was made to the support which the office provides and long-standing support it's provided to all bodies responsible for the rights of indigenous peoples. And at present, to the new mechanisms, the experts' mechanisms, the special rapporteurs, does the office intend to strengthen the secretariats of these mechanisms? And I'm thinking particularly of the experts' mechanisms, but I think that the special rapporteur, too, would need some greater assistance on the part of the office of the High Commissioner with some sort of permanent staffing, staff that's better trained, has more personnel available. And how does the Office of the High Commissioner intend to approach the relations or assistance it can provide for strengthening relations between the three bodies? I'm referring to the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum, first and foremost. These are the sorts of practices I'm asking about. Are the existing practices going to continue, or are they going to be strengthened, and if so, how? And then as far as plans for the future concern, predictions, I'm talking about the future now, not just work that's already been done with respect to distributing the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. What new forms may the Office of the High Commissioner offer in order to buttress an awareness of the new developments stemming from this declaration across the UN system, across the board? And I'm thinking in particular about practical ends, especially the website, for example. The website of the Office of the High Commission is very difficult to use. It's not user-friendly for those who want to get at the documentation of the special rapporteur. One gets directed to the experts' mechanism, then you have to go through all sorts of different steps before you get to the nitty-gritty. It's very difficult to get there if you're not very conversant with the website. And then there's the last point. How can one ensure that the information provided by the rapporteur, not just from formal trips, but also from regular work throughout the work, how can one ensure that this is published by the website? A very important part of this documentation is just not published, some of which may relate to work that was done weeks ago, for example, the recent visit to Chile. So where can we find the report of the special rapporteur on the Chaco de la Pava case in the Panama file? It doesn't seem to be published on the website. So how do we get this information? These details, practical details, logistical details, are very important for us. And lastly, and I really come to an end now, I want to talk about the possibilities before us for the future. How can the Office of the High Commissioner contribute to promoting, bolstering all of the efforts which have been made and will be made in interagency terms, with a view to making the rights of indigenous peoples more visible across the system. And I'd like to end on one very specific point. Hasn't the office thought about creating a specific unit for indigenous peoples and therefore enabling it to adapt to the post-declaration period, where you need to bear in mind that the minority rights issues are not necessarily identical to indigenous rights, and they seem to be covered by the same unit. Is there going to be a specific unit for the indigenous peoples? And if so, why not? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Clavera. Madam Lilian?
Merci, Madame la Présidente.
Thank you, Madam. I wanted to ask Ms. Arte a question with respect to a concern of mine, and that is on the major vulnerability of women caught up in migratory movements and various conflicts in the regions in which they live. We know that these women are caught up in unconscionable violence. And Mr. Anti said earlier that he drew consolation from the fact that now there were new mechanisms now in this partnership with the experts mechanism, with as a backdrop, the backcloth being the declaration. Is he thinking of working to ensure that from now on we can pinpoint the perpetrators of the violence meted out to indigenous women? And what is to be done to ensure that those acts don't go unpunished? Thank you, Antti.
Thank you very much to my colleague, Madame Mazangi. The next speaker representing the permanent forum, Mr. Smith. Mr. Colston Smith, you have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would also like to thank so much for the opening statement. That was not only clear, extremely clear, but also so relevant. It touched upon a number of the questions that I know the members of the Permanent Forum would like to put. But as my colleague Bartolomé Clavera already has shown, there are a number of the questions we might try to go into a bit more in depth. And for me, it's natural these days, as for so many, to take the starting point in the declaration. And as you mentioned in your opening statement, the main point is, after having got the declaration, after it's been having been adopted, it is to move, as you said, from paper to practice. Well, this declaration is now the superior law for the forum, for all indigenous issues, And I noted with satisfaction that in the opening statement this was stated just as strong as that, also with regard to the office of the commissioner. But this declaration, it poses a number of difficult questions for the forum, where we might get some help from the your office. This declaration, it states that the forum now has as a duty not only to promote full protection, full application for the declaration, but also to follow up the effectiveness of the declaration. Now, how shall the forum realize this duty, this new and very important duty? We know that all human rights violations are committed within the jurisdictions of the states. And, well, how shall the forum then react towards the state? And my question will be, can the forum have some kind of partnership with your office when raising questions to particular states as the direct contact with states are not a part of the, at least not a part of the direct mandate of the forum? This problem arises so often during the session of the forum. During this session, we listen to so many complaints that are of a specific character. And I think one may say that the forum is well organized as a body for input of complaints. We are open here. We are sitting here listening to complaints from all over the world. But we are not very well organized as a body for management and for finalizing of these problems. Very often we have much doubts as to what to do with the very serious complaints that have been presented here during the session. Well, one question would be, shall the forum, by way of a recommendation, more or less transfer them to your office, where you have a wider power, or shall we transfer them to the special rapporteur, or are there better methods in the opinion of your office? I would like to put that. I mean, this is really a question we meet every day here in the forum during a session. You mentioned yourself the Durban Review Conference. And I would like to put a question, but you could give us some more information about how the concerns of the indigenous peoples were reflected in this conference, and then what measures were taken by your office then to highlight the rights of indigenous peoples in that context. And also, what can be done in this respect in the follow-up phase. And then a rather practical, but principle also, point question from the forum. We, every year, address a number of recommendations to various addresses, and some of them also to the office of the High Commissioner. And my question would be whether such recommendations have resulted in concrete new activities from your office. And in that process in your office, I will put the question, could these recommendations have been formulated in a way better suited for actions from the side of your office? Could they be improved to make them more effective? And I would like to finalize with a, shall I say, a more fundamental question. And that is, in your office, you are dealing with all kinds of human rights. The human rights for the indigenous people, they have to be, after all, just one sector of your activities. And my question would be, how is the decision-making process in your office on this point? Well, this is, of course, of vital importance for the indigenous peoples and therefore also for the forum. How is the decision-making process within the system of the Office of the High Commissioner? And what are the criteria for this decision? How much you should use of your resources towards the indigenous people? Thank you so much.
Thank you very much to my colleague, Karsten Smith, for his excellent presentation of questions. And the next speaker from the Permanent Forum Membership, Margaret Lukawa. Margaret, you have the floor, madam.
Thank you much, Madam Chairperson. I want to thank Mr. Korebi for the elaborate information that he has given to us. It's quite timely, actually, when we receive this information, and I'm sure most indigenous peoples have learned a lot from his presentation. Thank you very much. Now, my question is, as head of the program that deals with the indigenous fellowship programs and also a program that awards grants to individuals coming to attend such forums of indigenous issues, how do you intend to popularize the program, especially after the declaration of the UN DRIP? I'm asking this because, one, most indigenous peoples, if I'm right, get difficulty in accessing information, looking at the literacy rates of indigenous peoples. Indigenous peoples would wish to come and join most colleagues to come and discuss issues that pertain to their lives. But the issue is accessing of information. So how do you popularize? The next question is, basically, when you look at the conditions or qualities for one to attain, for instance, a fellowship program, there's a lot of information required. Now, looking at these indigenous peoples, sometimes they may not fill in the category that is needed from the requirements. And yet, in a sense, they qualify to come and attend this kind of programs. What is your take on this? Thank you.
Excuse me.
Thank you very much to my colleague, Margaret Blakawa. We will at this point give the Office of the High Commissioner Representative, Mr. Korkiva, our attention, and he has the right to respond at this moment. Sir, you have the floor.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would like to sincerely thank the members of the forum for their very good questions, very fundamental questions in many cases, but we are here for an in-depth dialogue, so I do welcome that. I will probably not be able to give full answers to all the questions put, but perhaps give you some reflections, and I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to continue our discussions soon. Perhaps I start with a relatively, well, it's not an easy one, but a technical one, and that is the question of access to information and documentation, and in particular problems related to our website and the fact that it appears to be too difficult to use. I think even though this sounds like a technical question, it is actually an extremely important question, because it is true that much of the information, not only in terms of how to use procedures, but also in terms of the results of the procedures that are available, these are largely distributed through our website. And I'm aware that it is not as good as it should or could be, and we are looking at it, and actually there is currently a review going on, and there will probably be a relatively substantial reform of the whole website system. Hopefully, and I trust that will mean that you will have easy access to the expert mechanism site, to the site of the special rapporteur, and all the information will be made available as soon as possible. But this is my wish, and I have taken full note of your concern, and will bring it also to my colleagues in Geneva who are directly responsible for that. Now, this is partially also linked to the question of resources that you mentioned, because of course more resources might mean that things happen faster and all that. The question of providing additional resources to the expert mechanism and to the special rapporteur. I mean, as you probably know, the office has expanded quite rapidly in the past several years, in particular in the field. That has been the focus of the office to strengthen our country presence and regional presences. And now about half of the staff of the office is in those offices. And also through that, there is an additional support to the work in particular to the special rapporteurs, not so much for the expert mechanism that doesn't carry out country visits. So there the support is given in Geneva, and as in many other areas of the office, there is a feeling amongst the expert mechanism that the resources are not adequate. Of course, in the current financial situation, it is very difficult to expect any substantial increases. So I definitely am not in a position to make any promises in that respect. All I can say in respect of the unit that I'm responsible for is that within that office where we have the expert mechanism serviced, there's one person devoted to that task, but in addition to that, we do try to make sure that other colleagues who have other tasks will also contribute to the work of the expert mechanism to the extent they can. So I definitely see that as a key area of work for the unit. And the unit, as you rightly pointed out, deals with indigenous peoples and minorities. and you were calling for a specific unit on indigenous people's issues. Now, if you look at the size of the unit that we have now devoted to the indigenous peoples and minorities issues, we have 10, 11 staff members, and we have two staff members working on minority issues at the moment, and others are either on indigenous peoples issues, on the fellowship programs, and then there is half a person, Melanie's half, working on the voluntary fund and also on the slavery fund. So that is the current setup. So we are about 10 persons, and that is pretty much the size of a regular unit within the Office of the High Commissioner and in the Research and Right to Development branch where we division where we are located. So creating a specific unit would mean that we would have a kind of imbalance in the structure, unless we would get substantial human resources added to that, which, as I said, is not at all certain that will happen. But that being said, I think it is right to point out that there are fundamental differences in the work carried out on the issues of minority protection and on one hand, on the other hand, on indigenous peoples' issues. And we do have within the unit different components. There's one component of the unit working on indigenous peoples' issues and another one on minority issues. And although there are some interlinkages, for example, when we are now assisting the expert mechanism to draw up their study on education, within that context, it was useful in a workshop that we organized to have a rapporteur who wrote a report on minority education just last year to provide his take on their work. Of course, the end result is very different. There are many, many issues that are not covered in the minority education paper that will be covered on traditional education systems and educational autonomy and other issues. But there are some useful, at least, inspirational exchanges that can take place between the two areas of work. But I fully agree that these are two different areas, and of course the regime and the instruments are different. And I can just repeat that this is fully taken into account in the allocation of the work within the Office of the High Commissioner. Now, in terms of maybe I'll take next the issue of violence against women and the way in which the office and people concerned can get support. I think this is one area where we are clearly, I feel that we have to make sure that we don't concentrate solely on the instruments devoted to indigenous peoples, and whether it's expert mechanism or a special rapporteur. That is, of course, this special rapporteur in particular can in some cases be used in those cases as well, but there's a lot of work that is being done in the framework of the UN's work on human rights that can address those issues. And that is also part of the mainstreaming of indigenous peoples' concerns that I think is very important. And in that respect, I think indigenous peoples could more actively use, for example, the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, as well as the Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. These are tools that are available, of course, to everyone, but we must make sure that also indigenous peoples are informed about them and use these instruments. In terms of the thematic work, I should also underline that within the office, we do thematic work on indigenous peoples' issues, but there are other thematic units within the office that do very important work that can have implications and can be of use in your work to promote and protect the rights of indigenous peoples. For example, our unit dealing with rule of law has a number of projects and processes aimed to address issues such as impunity and rule of law questions more generally that are related to at least some of the concerns that you raise. So that is a general point I would like to emphasize, that there are human rights mechanisms and treaties and treaty bodies that could be used more actively by indigenous peoples, even though they have these bodies have with more general mandate. And that is related to the point raised by Mr. Smith in terms of the human rights complaints and the fact that within the permanent forum, many people raise individual and country-specific concerns and complaints, and that there's no real mechanism to process them. Now, of course, we as a unit, we don't have a mandate to come up with findings on specific countries or on individual situations either. What we can do is to make sure that such complaints are addressed according to the procedures that actually lead to the bodies that have a mandate to address those questions. And that may include CEDA, the Committee Against Committee for Elimination of Racial Discrimination, or it can be Human Rights Committee, it can be Special Rapporteur. There are many avenues that are available. I think, and this is something that I've been actually reflecting on in the course of this week, is that I do believe that forum, given this very impressive presence of indigenous activists with serious concerns, given the presence of these individuals and organizations, I do think that we could work, for example, in terms of attaching serious hands-on training activities to these sessions that would equip the individuals concerned to submit the complaints to the right address. And it is, as I said, it is not my unit, but we can facilitate the process. And I think the issue of training on human rights complaint mechanisms and opportunities that exist is extremely important, and that is one area. And of course, as you have discussions within the forum, and there are issues that are raised, some of them repeatedly, there are thematic concerns that emerge from those discussions. And there again, there might be human rights thematic concerns that you identify, bring to our attention, and maybe we can work together to come up with some sort of thematic activities to address those thematic concerns that relate to indigenous people's rights. So that would be my comment on that. And then related comment is, of course, the information or how to make sure that treaty bodies behind the Committee on the Rights of the Child are fully informed about the declaration and more generally about the rights of indigenous peoples. I think there are many ways in which this can be done, and one important element is to make sure that they are invited to our related activities. As an example, last month we had a discussion in the context of the expert mechanism on the rights of indigenous peoples on the issue of right to education. And there we invited as one of the experts and one of the participants, a member of the Committee on the Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. So she was present, taking active part in a discussion that was about her treaty, but also about the declaration, about the issue of indigenous people's rights, right to education more generally. So that was, to me at least, also a two-way street. I mean, we learned from her, and hopefully she also, with a number of indigenous experts present, also learned a number of new things about the indigenous people's concerns and the declaration. So that is something we would like to continue. And of course, the expert mechanism is one forum where this can be done. It can be done here as well. I mean, there are many opportunities. And as I mentioned in my introductory remarks, the office has done some training initiatives or briefings on the declaration for representatives of the treaty bodies. So that is one step. But again, it will not happen overnight. Even though everybody in this room knows a lot about the declaration and its principles, it is still in the overall human rights scheme. It is a young instrument and not known fully by people working on human rights, not specializing in indigenous issues. So there's a lot that we can do there. Maybe I should then address the issue of participation, because I think Mr. Clavero was asking about the procedures or potential methods of enhancing indigenous people's participation in different mechanisms and different bodies. I mean, there are some examples where this has been done by the member states. I mean, expert mechanism is an example where the original mandate of the Human Rights Council was drafted so that it did encourage indigenous participation, but it did not say that everybody has to be indigenous. Mm-hmm. But the member states actually went even further than or implemented it really to a maximum effect, and now we have really a body that is a body of indigenous peoples. So that is one recent example. There are at the same time, I do think that it is extremely important that there will not be just, well, indigenous human rights bodies, and then there are human rights bodies where the others are the experts. And in that respect, I think it is very important that also in the context of more general human rights work and human rights activities of the UN and other organizations, indigenous participation is taken into account, and that is one important point I'd like to make. In addition to that, I do think that there are also a number of things that we as an office can do and are trying to do, but can probably do better in terms of building that capacity that opens those doors and gives indigenous representatives the skills and knowledge that will make it possible for and contacts and all that will make it possible for them to get a seat at all the bodies concerned. And I think one contribution that we do make is I think the fellowship program, which is very in-depth program. It's a four-month program through which young indigenous leaders really learn the ins and outs of UN human rights mechanisms, not only those dealing with indigenous peoples specifically, but things like the UPR, Human Rights Committee, and others. And that is already yielding some results. You are now seeing some fellows finding positions within the organization and within the bodies that deal with human rights and are there as key key partners. And I would also like to emphasize that that particular fellowship program, even though it is administered by us and coordinated by us, it's an example of excellent interagency cooperation, because we have the Office of the High Commissioner, but then we have a number of others. ILO is very active, WIPO is very active, UNICEF, UNESCO, UNDP, all the organizations UN agencies that have a mandate in this field contribute to that. And that's one element. But that, again, is not enough to change the world overnight. And I think we will soon expand that program and make it even more effective. And that is bringing me to the question of how to make sure that people have access to the application process, and that the application or admission criteria actually take into account the concerns of indigenous peoples, who are keen to take part. And there are definitely barriers there. There are some things that we have already done to expand the reach, and one of these things is the inclusion of specific language components. It used to be English only. Now we have Spanish and French. That is, again, not enough for many, but at least it has expanded it significantly in terms of the expectations as to what you have to actually submit. These are partially part of the control mechanisms that we have to put in place in order to make sure that we can justify we can really justify that this person is the right beneficiary, and I know that they may seem bureaucratic at times, but at the same time we don't have the capacity to have one-on-one interviews. Although for the fellowship we do it on the phone, so there's a lot of documentation required, and I don't see an easy way out from that. Maybe I should say that in terms of dissemination of the information, we do try to use our network of indigenous organizations. We submit information on the fellowships and the travel grants through a newsletter that is distributed to thousands of people through the internet. So hopefully that will keep on expanding and more people will reach it. I should say that in addition to the fellowship program, those people who are here on the voluntary fund grant are also going to be part of a network we're trying to build. We're trying to build a resource, a sort of directory containing all past beneficiaries of the voluntary funds. That would mean I don't know how many people. Melanie would know better. A thousand beneficiaries by now, and again, that can be used to build capacity and networks amongst indigenous activities and help their work in this field. Now, are there some key questions that I left out?
Even if you have, I think we have to open up the floor for the other speakers. There's quite a long list of indigenous speakers who would like to speak, but there's only one government, so I'll give the floor first to the government who wants to speak, and then I'll call on the various indigenous peoples. But I'd also request that this is more a question part, because he is not the special rapporteur on indigenous people's rights. No, he is the OHCHR, so it's more asking questions in relation to his work as a staff of the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights. So I'd like to give the floor to Freddy Mamani of the Bolivia government. You have the floor, sir.
No sé si estoy equivocado en el punto, pero entiendo que es el...
I know that the... in this context, on behalf of Bolivia, well, the plurinational state of Bolivia, I would like to thank the OHCHR for its report. And the fact is that the massacre and killing of our indigenous fellow countrymen in Cobija was a crime. And I would also like to say that the OHCHR have spoken out about it, and they defend the human rights of indigenous people, and they have spoken out and condemned such acts of terrorism, not only in our country, but in other countries throughout the continent. And the goal of such actions in Bolivia is to kill our president and vice president and other authorities. And I would like to say that the Bolivian government instituted the 24th of May as a national day to combat racism, and we just want to recall that just a year ago, radical right-wing and conservative groups attacked a number of indigenous peoples, and this was condemned by various international organizations. And in this context, we would like to say that we intend to continue furthering the defense of indigenous peoples and upholding the human rights of all of our citizens. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Freddy Mamani from the Observer State of Bolivia. We'll now go to the list of indigenous peoples, and again, I'll reiterate that if you can please just focus on clarifications or questions you would ask from, you would like to ask from the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights. I'd like to call on Hilaria Supa Huaman, who is a Congress member from Peru and Vice President of the Parlamento Indígena de América. Is she here? No? Okay, let's move on to Mr. Ghislaine Picard of the Assembly of First Nations. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The right to adequate housing is a fundamental human right. In Kitsakik, Quebec, Canada, 425 Algonquin people live in a community that has no water, no sanitation services, and no electricity. Difficult to believe, I would even say disturbing, that we speak of a situation in Canada where the occupancy rate in Indigenous homes is almost twice the national average. Following his mission to Canada, the former Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing, Milon Kotari, concluded in his report that the situation for Indigenous peoples in Canada in the area of housing, safe water, and sanitation services is unacceptable. We urge the Office of the High Commissioner to press on the Government of Canada to implement those recommendations of the report of the Special Rapporteur on Adequate Housing pertaining to Indigenous peoples. We also would like to encourage the Office of the High Commissioner and the High Commissioner herself to promote and implement the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We would like to ask, what other activities can your office do to promote this the declaration? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ghislaine Picard from the Assembly of First Nations. The next one is Melissa Saunders, who is from National Native Title Council, Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement, and other Indigenous organizations in Australia. Is Melissa Saunders in the room? No? The next one is Sarah Fortune, who is from the Amasir Caucus. You have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson and Representative of OHC HR. I have three questions that have to do with the topic of impunity. Movement of people, displacement, and the issue of extraction industries and the harm that they cause to the environment and to human beings. First question is on impunity. Thousands of Tuaregs were massacred in Mali and Niger. We have lists. We have established lists. And of course, we have some pictures as well. 126 people were killed in Kabylia in 2001 by policemen, by gendarmes. And just yesterday in Morocco, during a music festival, a Mazig spectator is holding up Mazig flags, were beaten and humiliated. There's also the scorched earth policy in the Kabylia region of Algeria. Forests are burned out because it's thought that terrorists are hiding there. So, first question, what are the procedures and measures of the United Nations to bring the perpetrators of these massacres in the past and today, which continue to perpetrate such massacres, to bring them to justice at the highest level of the state authorities in Mali, Niger, and Algeria? That's my first question. Second question with respect to movement or displacement of human beings. You know Tuaregs are moved around in Algeria and Burkina Faso. They've been displaced. What assistance can OHCHR provide to have these people recognized as refugees? Some of these individuals are students and cannot enroll in a university. They don't have the means. They need a status of refugee to have a possibility of surviving, continuing their studies. The last my questions has to do with the extraction industries in Niger. Areva, the multinational company, staged things perfectly. They operate the third largest mining site around the world, and with the participation of indigenous peoples. How is it possible? What can the UN do so that these multinationals respect the rights, fully respect the rights in the framework of the contracts that they signed with the state? And the provisions and rights of indigenous peoples. What can be done, given that the indigenous peoples did not give prior consent? Of course, there have not been reparations provided since this company has not been operating these uranium mines it's been operating these uranium mines for a long time. This goes back in the past, and I'm just wondering whether all these issues are taken into account. This largest market for uranium that has just opened in Niger, are these provisions and the issues of rights taken into account by Areva? That's my last question. Of course, we'll keep in mind our last proposal, and if we can meet up with you, I hope that. Thank you in advance for setting aside some time for us and to have an individual interview. Thank you very much, madam.
Thank you very much, representative of the Amasig Caucus. The next one is Jose Manuel Brunei from Fain, and after him, Jiten Yumnam for the Forum on Indigenous Perspectives and Action. Is Jose Manuel Brunei in the room? Yes, you have the floor, sir. Press the button.
I would like to warmly greet all the delegates from various countries representing indigenous peoples and to the chairman. Unfortunately, the speaker is speaking too close to the mic.
Your mouth very close to the mic. You speak further. Yeah, okay.
I'd like to support the various statements by different indigenous peoples that we've heard over the past few days, and also this issue of upholding our rights. More than anything, this afternoon, on behalf of the indigenous peoples of Ecuador and the youth, indigenous youth in Ecuador, we'd like to express our feelings on a topic that we think is very important, And that is our indigenous migrant brothers and sisters. I'd like to congratulate some of the speakers who mentioned this, and also in the northern countries here and European countries and Western Europe, there are many people living from Ecuador as immigrants working. However, there's discrimination there against them because they're immigrants and they're indigenous peoples. And this is a major concern for us, and I would like to ask the OHCHR and the Office of Indigenous Issues to really look into this matter and to consider this very important issue. What I want to also ask is, what is being done, or what you intend to do on the issue of our migrant indigenous peoples, because sometimes they work in subhuman, inhuman conditions, even though they make a considerable contribution through their work. They contribute to the economy of the countries where they live, but they are not recognized. Their rights are not recognized. Often they are exploited. They're mistreated, and the governments, the authorities of the countries where they live, don't treat them very well. This is something that we hold very close to heart, and I want to thank you very much for replying to my question. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I call now on Jiten Yumnam, who will speak for the Forum on Indigenous Perspectives and Action and Asia Pacific Indigenous Youth. You have the floor, sir.
I would like to first thank the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights for its relentless effort in promoting and protecting human rights worldwide. I would like to raise some questions and also come up with a few recommendations. First is, in terms of, there are several countries like India that doesn't recognize the existence of indigenous peoples, and as such, the UN DRIP declaration doesn't immediately apply and the rights inapplicable. So what steps can the OICHR take to ensure that these countries recognize the rights of indigenous peoples, existence of indigenous peoples? And secondly, on the recommendations by the treaty bodies on indigenous peoples in certain countries like India, say for example, the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, it comes up with a series of recommendations on India in 2007 on the aspect of right to self-determination, on the need to respect the right to free and informed consent. But the problem is the government has so far failed to implement those recommendations. And there are other recommendations of the Human Rights Committee too, way back in 1997. So what steps or what initiative has the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights has taken to ensure that these recommendations of the treaty bodies and also by the recommendations by the special procedures mechanisms can be implemented by the respective states? And also in India, I find that the Office of the High Commissioner, there is no Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. So and that led to a situation where, indigenous peoples, where we live in a conflict situation with human rights violation, with impunity, so it's physically impossible for us to gain access to Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights when there are serious cases of human rights violation committed with impunity. So, is there a possibility, or is there an effort on the part of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights to establish an office in India? And also, there are a few recommendations which I'm submitting to you, but I'll read out a couple of recommendations just briefly. I would like to request the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights to urge upon the Government of India to implement the provisions of UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, to repeal the Armed Forces Special Powers Act that suspend right to life, as recommended by the UN Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, and also to recommend the Government of India to implement the recommendations of the UN Human Rights Committee in 1997 to adopt a political response to the political conflict in Manipur, in Northeast India, and also to urge upon the Government of India to submit its fourth periodic report to the Human Rights Committee of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And finally, I would like to thank the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights and also the Madam Chairperson of the Permanent Forum for giving me this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Jiten Yumnam. I call now on Raja Devashish Roy, who will speak on behalf of the Asia Caucus. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairperson. And thanks to Mr. Antti Korkeakivi on behalf of the Asian Indigenous Peoples Caucus for your presentation and also for meeting us earlier for discussions. We have submitted and distributed our views in writing. They are, however, in the form of recommendations rather than questions. And following the guidance of the chair, I now have the pleasant task of converting some of these suggestions into questions. However, before that, let me just mention our central recommendation that the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is integrated into the functioning of all human rights mechanisms, with the OHCHR taking the lead. As Mr. Korkeakivi just said, many mechanisms still do not know much about this young declaration, which is screaming for implementation. Now, a few general questions. One is what I just said. How can we, the OHCHR, ensure that the UNDRIP, the declaration, is integrated into the regular policy framework of different UN bodies and invoked and used by them, including by the UN Human Rights Special Procedures that Jiten just mentioned, by the UN Human Rights Council's Universal Periodical Review and the UN Human Rights Treaty Monitoring Bodies, including through the allocation of additional resources, perhaps. The second general question is, how can OHCHR promote among UN member states respect for and implementation of the provisions of the declaration? Now, I have a number of specific questions. One is, how will OHCHR help ensure that adequate resources and technical assistance is provided to Indigenous peoples delegations engaging with different human rights mechanisms, including those under the Human Rights Council? And in this case, we refer to the proposal at the expert mechanism right last year. I think a recommendation to the General Assembly to amend the rules so that the UN Voluntary Fund can facilitate Indigenous delegations' representation in the treaty bodies and other UN processes. Another question is we would like to pose to you is, how can your office include Indigenous peoples in its secretariat to ensure that Indigenous peoples' concerns are duly reflected in the decision-making processes of the OHCHR? Another is, how can additional resources and additional technical and logistical support be provided to the work of the expert mechanism, MRIP, and also the Office of the Special Rapporteur? We know that they have to share your office with many other thematic rapporteurs, etc. But we also realize that Indigenous peoples, being one of the most disadvantaged sections of humanity, we need some special efforts. And also with regard to the Special Rapporteur, current funding, I think, allows only 2 country visits a year. So we would like to say that more money should be given to enable him to have more visits and also to hold regional consultations and other meetings with Indigenous peoples. I have 2 more, I think. How can the OHCHR engage itself more actively with national human rights institutions? This is very, very important, because that's where it all happens, and the OHCHR only has country offices and very few offices, for example, Nepal, but that's a separate case, very few in South Asia. And reminding everybody that Asia is the only region where we still don't have regional human rights monitoring mechanism. Seventh, how can OHCHR establish and strengthen partnerships with Indigenous organizations, particularly, for example, in capacity-building activities? And we would also like to know if the OHCHR is thinking of expanding or establishing offices in countries where there are serious human rights violations and where national human rights mechanisms are either absent or they are weak. And Madam Chair, now I come to our last question. Will the OHCHR designate Indigenous focal persons in wherever you have country offices where there are serious cases of human rights violations against Indigenous peoples? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I'd like now to call on Rosalba Gomez Gutierrez, who will make a joint statement from the Mexican Indigenous Peoples Organizations.
No, she's not in. Okay, I go to Lori Johnston from the Yamasee People Center for Organization Research and Education. I'd like to also request that you ask questions instead of making a full statement. Thank you very much. You have the floor. Where is Lori? You are the Mexican joint statement from Mexico?
No.
Yeah, okay, I'll just give her first the floor, the Mexican organizations. Yes, you have the floor. You are Patricia, aren't you? Okay, Patricia.
Mi nombre es Patricia Rivera.
I'm Patricia Rivera, representing the Mexican organizations. Could the chair please ask the speaker to speak more slowly? It is physically impossible to interpret at this speed.
More slowly, please. The interpreter can't deal with it.
E diagonal.
The speaker is now reading out a number. It's not clear what it refers to. This refers to the fourth period of the Indigenous Forum, the fourth session in May 2005. This recommendation, which the forum issued, was geared to four agencies, WIPO, UNESCO, UNIFEM, and UNDP, the speaker is speaking far too fast, Chairman. It's impossible to interpret.
She said she cannot interpret you, so you better speak slowly or else we're wasting a lot of time here.
Muy bien.
So I'm referring to a recommendation which this forum supported. It's been complied with, and the report has been conveyed to the Secretariat. Mexico, human rights, achieving justice. In the political constitution of the states of the Mexican nation, we establish clearly the fundamental rights of all Mexicans, which have to be respected and protected, as well as the provisions of Convention 169 of the ILO. The first paragraph of Article 4 of the political constitution of the United States of Mexico enshrines equality before the law of men and women. Likewise, paragraph 3 of the same legal instrument establishes that any person has the right to have protection of health without any distinction amongst individuals, and no distinction between free persons and detainees. This is also included in the Constitution, providing for banning of any discrimination. Thousands of indigenous prisoners and non-indigenous prisoners are still demanding justice in Mexico, asking not to be starved, not to be hit, not to be kept in cold rooms, and not to be prevented from having family visits. In other words, they're calling for the law to be complied with, the same law which has to be enforced with the same vigor as the way in which they were imprisoned in the first place. Very often, peoples are in a situation of crisis because of high levels of corruption, violence, and violations of human rights. Very often, the treatments used in the penitentiary institutions are particularly violent. Now I move on to the recommendations. We request this permanent forum to recommend that the Special Rapporteur for Indigenous Issues visit officially our country, Mexico, and issue a recommendation on the penitentiary system in the country, where people detained of freedom include indigenous men and women, who, like any individual, has a paramount right to dignity as human beings. Secondly, we demand justice and clarification about the disappearance of the Creekies women. The speaker's given three names of those individuals who've disappeared, as well as the murders of a number of other individuals, the names of which the speaker is giving at top speed. the permanent forum should recommend that the Mexican state formally hire permanent indigenous translators, trained beforehand and conversant in indigenous languages, who should be available and operational throughout the whole legal proceedings. Fourthly, the permanent forum. Interruption from the chair.
Stop yes. asking questions to the Office of the High Commissioner on Human Rights. Conclude si. Your statement, please.
Muy bien.
Very well. We request very respectfully of this permanent forum that it review the recommendations which have been issued since the start of the forum for the indigenous peoples, especially in the case of Lower California, as well as other indigenous communities in our country. Thank you, madam.
Thank you very much, Ms. Rosalba Gomez. No, Patricia Rivera. Let's go now to Ms. Laurie Johnston. You have the floor, madam.
Thank you, Mr. Corkingham, for protecting the indigenous peoples that our Creator put here to care for our winds, waters, and lands. We have some questions. How do we get more human rights investigators dedicated to indigenous human rights violations? How can we get translators, advisors, printers, everything that is materially needed to produce a human rights complaint in the prescribed format? How can we get all that at a human rights complaint desk at the permanent forum in the future? And we have several questions. Can your office do a study on indigenous human rights and the lack of practical implementation of the declaration so that we can get a UN convention on indigenous human rights and actually enforce human rights violations against indigenous peoples? And how can indigenous peoples work with your office to do a report on the following? The technique of national militaries taking over lands of indigenous peoples, violence against those asserting environmental sovereignty, oppression of unrepresented or unrecognized peoples, war crimes against indigenous peoples, including rape. And that's all. Thank you. Should we email that to you, or what is the process for getting
feedback? Will you
feedback?
Just raise the questions, and he will choose what he needs to respond to. And if he cannot respond to it, we will just have communications. I'd like to ask the last two speakers, Les Malizer, who is from the Foundation for Aboriginal and Islander Research Action, FIRA. Les Malizer, you have the floor, and after him, Nay Casamon. Yes, Les.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. As some of my questions have been raised, I'll be very brief. Can Indigenous persons be appointed to senior positions specifically relating to Indigenous peoples in the office? Shouldn't Indigenous persons also hold a cross-section of the positions generally available in the office with the stipulation that such appointments be outside the regional quotas applying to UN positions? Thirdly, why is it not possible to have an autonomous structure of Indigenous peoples unit in the office rather than the current Indigenous Peoples and Minorities Unit? What can be done to encourage the treaty bodies to recognise Indigenous Peoples' right to self-determination? And finally, will the office direct financial resources to the establishment and maintenance of an Indigenous Permanent Office in Geneva to assist Indigenous delegations, particularly now that the Human Rights Council sits for 12 weeks a year and there is a UPR procedure? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Very much, Les Malizer. And our last speaker is Nay Casamon, who is from the Mon Unity League. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Yes, I'm from Burma. I'm representative from Burma. So in Burma...
We have to give the point of order to the government of Myanmar. Yes.
The name of the country officially in the United Nations is Myanmar. Yeah. So if the other participants or delegates using not the official name is not according to the rules and procedure of the meeting, it's not allowed.
Okay.
Another thing is, madam, the question to be raised by the distinguished participant from Moon Group, supposed to be relevant to the agenda item, and then not to be country specific. It's supposed to be the thematic issue, or supposed to be related to the issue of the discussion.
Yeah.
So that's my point of order.
Okay.
Thank you, madam.
Yes, please. Can you just adhere to use the term Burma and also to be relevant to the issue that we are discussing here? You have the floor.
Yes, thank you. I can use Myanmar. No problem. So in our country, there are many, about 40% of people are indigenous people, and the majority are Burman people. Yes, we agree on that. So they use Myanmar. Okay, we agree on that. So in the human rights situation, I would like to point out there are two problems in Burma. One problem is about democratic situation in Burma, democratic transition in Burma. Now,
you are now using again Burma. I think I said you
in Myanmar.
Agreed.
Sorry, in Myanmar. So, democratization is in deadlock because the currently Aung San Suu Kyi pro-democracy leader was under arrest. Secondly, I would like to point out about the right of self-determination of indigenous people in Myanmar. About 40% of indigenous people, Mon, Karen, Yakai, Arakanese, Shan, and many, about 100 indigenous people have no right at all. So the current government, Myanmar military government, constitution did not guarantee for the rights of those indigenous people.
So can you ask your question now?
I would like to very glad that human rights special reporter can often visit to Myanmar. But special reporter on human rights can only visit in prison and in the city. Special reporter have no mandate by Myanmar government to visit in most of ethnic region area. So finally, I would like to ask Office of Human Rights, Office of Commission on Human Rights, that whether you have a mechanism that to enforce human rights principle in Burma, in Myanmar, sorry.
Okay, thank you very much.
Are you? And also, secondly, I would like to have your office to have consultation with Myanmar government to set up human rights protection office in Myanmar, if possible, because we are hungrily needs protection from the international community. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can I please?
Free Aung San Suu Kyi.
Excuse me. Excuse me. Is that the right of reply? The government of Myanmar.
I would like to ask for the right of reply, madam.
Okay. You have the floor.
Thank you. Very brief,
because we are losing time now. Yeah.
Yes, madam. Okay. I would be very brief. First thing is that our distinguished colleague, participant from Moon Unity League, he mentioned that the constitution, which was adopted very recently, does not have the rights of the indigenous people. So that's the different from the reality, and then I would like to clarify the discrepancy in his statement. That is, as you know, about 95% of the ethnic and indigenous group, armed groups, totaling more than 100,000 have already returned to the peace agreement.
Can I ask you to stop filming that? We have a rule that you cannot film a member speaking if he is speaking, unless you get his permission. Please proceed.
Thank you, madam. And then, now we have some splinter group that is 5% of the remaining ethnic indigenous splinter groups. They are now working. The majority of the indigenous formerly insurgent groups, more than 100,000 people. They are now working together with the government, and then they are the active participant in the national political process. So if the Hmong group says the indigenous groups doesn't have the right, and then government is abusing the rights of the indigenous groups, how could the former insurgent groups, indigenous insurgent groups, more than 100,000 people are able to cooperate with the current government? How could they see the, if their accusation is correct, how could they participate in the political process of the government is doing at this moment? That's the, my right of reply to the accusation made by the splinter group of the Moon Unity Group. Thank you, Madam.
Thank you very much, sir. I would like now to call on our expert, Mr. Antti Kirby, to respond, and then after that, I will call on the members of the forum to make their concluding statements. Mr. Kirby, can you respond? It's a question. Can ask the question, but he will not have time to answer now. Okay, you ask the question now.
Yeah, good.
First and foremost, I should like to ask you to thank you, for this very important presentation. I think that the information we listened to was very important, but I would like to know whether there are any new developments related to the budget of the Office of the High Commissioner and the allocations channeled towards the human rights of the indigenous people. I think that following the latest review, there should be more allocations to indigenous people. And with regard to scholarships, there are scholarships to the Francophones, to the French-speaking. There are no scholarships and there are no grants for Arab-speaking indigenous people. And this is a very important point. With regard to the review, the Universal Periodic Review, there is the expert mechanism. However, its role is very limited with regard to submitting studies, and we must not undermine the role of this expert mechanism with regard to following up on violations. Within the past 2 days, as was mentioned by the Amazigh caucus, there were 10 people who were arrested because they went to a music concert and they carried the flag of their group. And this is a peaceful flag. And we called for the integration of this group within a democratic constitutional amendment. Last but not least, I think that in the past there was consensus with regard to minorities and indigenous groups. And then they were divided. They were called the minorities and the indigenous groups. This is an issue that my colleagues have raised. However, we should like to know whether you have a plan in order to establish a unit dedicated to indigenous people, because we need to protect the land and the resources of the indigenous people, and we need more allocations from the budget for that. Thank you.
My colleague Hassan Iqbal Qasam, I'll now give you the floor, Antti Kirby.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone, for these questions. I have a lot of them. I have much more questions to answer than I have time. I have 1 minute. I was worried this morning, my friends at the UNDP, they received 50 questions. I was worried that I would not receive that type of number, but I'm glad to see that the interest is there also for the work of the Office of the High Commissioner. So I will try to cover as many as I can of these questions. I will, of course, not be able to comment on country situations. That is not my role here and not my mandate. But I will try to address those thematic issues that relate to the situations that you mentioned. Maybe starting with the question of national human rights institutions, because I fully agree that their role is extremely, extremely important in terms of the implementation of human rights generally and also the rights of indigenous peoples. We have within the office, we have a specific unit dealing with national human rights institutions, and I am now exploring with them the possibility of having more activities or discussions with national human rights institutions as to how indigenous people's issues could be addressed by them more consistently. I know it is already the case in a number of institutions, but not necessarily in all relevant ones. That relates also to the question of the field presences of the office, because as was mentioned by some of the speakers, we do not have presence in all the countries. Human rights violations take place in every single country of the world, and our field presence is limited to 50 countries, I think, or something like that at the moment. And we will not be able to cover all countries in the at least not in the immediate future in through country presences. My point in terms of linking this is that when we don't have presence, it is particularly important in those cases to make sure that then we work closely with those national institutions that have a human rights mandate that can use the mechanisms and the standards provided by the UN to protect human rights. So I'm definitely in agreement with the point that we should step up cooperation with national human rights institutions. Related to the field presences, there was also a comment on the focal points for indigenous peoples. We have them in a number of cases, in particular in Latin America. I think in a number of our field presences, there are focal points for indigenous peoples. I will take the message back to Geneva that there was a call to make sure that this practice is expanded. Now, in terms of the issues related to adequate housing and violations of housing rights, without going into any country-specific examples, I should just like to emphasize that it is an issue that the office has been working on, and it has, for example, carried out in partnership with UN Habitat work on housing and the goal and the resulting document is policy guide on housing for indigenous people. So that is definitely a reference document that is important to keep in mind, in addition to of course using in individual cases all the human rights mechanisms that are available in this particular field. I would then perhaps say a few words about the extractive industries and the extrajudicial killings that were raised as an issue. Again, without going into any country specific situations, I would like to just recall that we have a special rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, and that mandate is executions, and that is a mechanism that can address these allegations. In terms of the extractive industries, you had an in-depth discussion on that earlier this week, so definitely everybody agrees that it's a key issue for indigenous peoples. We in the Office of the High Commissioner, I mentioned in my presentation, we have also carried out activities in this area, and also the Special Rapporteur mentioned that this is a priority area in his activities. So definitely that is, in terms of thematic focus, something we all share as a concern, and also I think an area where we can join forces to make sure that this priority issue stays high on the agenda. Now, in terms of indigenous migrants, again, that's an area that we have had some activities in the past, and definitely within the office of the High Commissioner, the issue of the rights of migrants is considered a very important question more generally. And of course, indigenous peoples often face the same problems as other migrants, plus they have additional concerns in many instances. So definitely we have to make sure that in these discussions we keep the indigenous specific perspective in the picture and try to make sure that whatever we do in terms of protecting rights of migrants also take into account those additional concerns that indigenous peoples have. We do have there is a convention dealing with the rights of migrant workers that is a treaty that has not been ratified as widely as many other human rights instruments, but in some instances it is in force and can also be of use. In terms of there were some office related questions. First question was the presence of how to enhance recruitment opportunities for indigenous peoples within the office of the High Commissioner, and I assume within the UN more generally. We have some indigenous staff within the office, and we've had some consultants and others, but it is definitely an issue that merits attention. And my understanding is that one of the projects underway is a study to be carried out by ILO on obstacles to UN employment faced by indigenous peoples. That would identify some of the questions, and then of course we will have to see how to remove those to make sure that there are better opportunities where there are undue obstacles for recruitment for indigenous peoples. But of course this is again not a problem that can be fixed overnight. It is related to other efforts of capacity building, contacts, and all these things that I mentioned earlier, and of course we have the regular UN recruitment rules in force for everyone. So I certainly am not in a position to promise any changes at this point into those particular regulations. But it is definitely an issue that is being looked at, and I think this ILO study can be an important resource for further steps in this respect. The issue of separate indigenous unit, I thought I covered that to some extent. Again, as the situation is now, I of course, as the person responsible for indigenous and minorities, you know, would be happy to see more resources, but that is not in my hands. And as you all know, the additional resources are difficult to come by, and indigenous peoples are an important area of activity for the office, but there are competing extremely important human rights issues that are also crying for more resources. So that is a challenge that the office is facing, how to ensure adequate support for all priority areas. And I certainly hope that the indigenous issues will continue to be strengthened in terms of the office allocation and priority setting. Now, in terms of how the priorities are set, we are within the office, we are guided by our strategic management plan. It's a two-year plan that is currently running is for 2008 and 2009, and it is a document that also then guides the more specific priority setting within different branches. And there you will see a number of references to indigenous peoples' issues, and also to the issue of promotion of the declaration, and also importantly to the issue of interagency cooperation in the field of indigenous peoples, and to the mainstreaming of indigenous peoples' issues within the UN system. And that is definitely that we will continue to work on, and but cannot work by ourselves. We will do it together with our partner agencies, and hopefully we will see further results in this respect. So yeah. Maybe that's I'm starting to answer. I know there are many questions. I apologize to those whose questions are still unanswered. I hope that I can find another way to communicate my points to you. So
well,
thank you very
we
much.
Would like to thank first the interpreters for giving us an extension of 10 minutes, so we were able to get the interpretation. We don't have interpretation anymore. We don't have interpretations anymore, but I would like us to continue for a little while if any of the colleagues would like to say something, but the electricity will also go out in 5 minutes. So are my colleagues going to say something? Yes, Mr. Carson Smith, please. Yeah.
Well, if I should evaluate this dialogue in depth, I'll say it has been a success for two reasons. It has been really a dialogue with questions and answers. And it has been so many problems that have been answered in depth. So I should think that our chair should bring express a profound thank to the representatives of the Office of the High Commissioner from the members of the forum.
Yes, thank you very much. Indeed, I think this has been a very fruitful dialogue, and we really think that with us doing this, we can really do it more through the years. And I really would like to thank Auntie Kirby being on his own. You know, the other agencies, we had several people, but we had also Melanie Clerk was also here helping him. But he indeed has tried his best. So. Yeah, and I thank all the colleagues for all the questions that they have raised, that they have developed, and all the indigenous participants, as well as the governments, have also raised the questions. Let me now make an announcement before we leave. All the members of the forum, you know, Monday is a holiday, so there's no official session, but the members of the forum are going to meet from 10 to 6, I'm afraid. So we are going to meet in DC2 in room 19. No, we have to, 19th floor, DC2, and we have to be there at 10 o'clock because we have to look at all the recommendations.
It's
10 to 4. 10 to 4. Oh, it's 10 to 4. Okay, so let me wish all the participants a happy weekend and a long weekend at that. And we will see you again on Tuesday where we will continue this dialogue. Thank you very much, and this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.